justice as a virtue. So it's a habitus, which is to say it's also a perfection of the human person. Virtues, Aquinas says over and over again, if you read through his disputed questions on the virtues or anywhere else where he treats the virtues, he says that they make their possessors good and their work done well, right? So virtues enable you to do your work well. And what is the work proper to a human being? So that's one question you should bear in mind as I continue to reflect. What does one mean by the work of a human being? And they make you good, right? Now that's something that's familiar to you already, of course. Virtues make you good. So if we don't think of justice typically these days as a virtue, what do we think of it as? And what do you think of justice as? What comes to mind when you think of justice? I would suggest that for many of you, you think about law courts, or you think about the federal government or the state government, or you think about other institutions. And you might also think about certain kinds of advocacy, right, as in the term social justice, right? But we often don't think about justice as the virtue of an individual, right? And there's nothing wrong, of course, with thinking about justice as attached to institutions. And there's a philosophical account that I could give for how we came to think of justice principally as attached to virtue. Some of you no doubt have heard of John Rawls, a great American philosopher who argues that justice is the principal virtue of institutions, right? So it's a kind of societal thing. He's not clear on what exactly a virtue is. But still, we somehow found this to make its way into the dominant culture where whether you've read John Rawls or not, you tend not to think of justice as principally a perfection of a human being, but rather somebody else's job, right? You go to the court to receive justice. You have a conversation with your professor about a grade that you got. Something in your paper was overlooked, you think, and you're seeking justice. You think you're seeking redress. And there are principles of justice that animate our conversations. And then if you think of this kind of weaponized version of justice that is in terms of the social justice warrior, right? You think of advocating for particular rights. And some of those rights might be consonant with the Catholic intellectual tradition, and some of them certainly are not. But still, it's worth asking, you know, how did we get here? How do we think of justice in terms of advocating for particular rights? And I think a large part of the answer to that question has to do with the way we think about a human person, right? And I want to draw a little bit from the philosopher Alistair MacIntyre, who I think Dr. Tolleson is teaching a course on this semester, I heard, as well as Dr. Bernard Williams, is that right? So Alistair MacIntyre, who's a prolific Catholic moral philosopher, his latest book that came out in 2016, Ethics and the Conflicts of Modernity, he reflects upon what he calls morality, which, if you've read G.E.M. Anscombe, is not all that dissimilar to what she means by modern moral philosophy. There's a lot of similarity there. And the view of the human person that is connected to that. MacIntyre thinks in terms of a dominant conception of what it is to be a human being as a individualistic preference maximizer, right? And that sounds perhaps a little peculiar, so let me break that down. An individualistic, well, he argues that the contemporary and modern conception of the human being as an individual is already in large part fictional, right? That we are not fundamentally individuals, at least in the sense derived from John Locke and his heirs. That is to say, we don't begin our existence, or our state of nature is not that of being simply by ourselves without community. Right? So Hobbes and then Locke and other thinkers argue that that is our natural state, and we enter into community by means of voluntary acts, right? We choose to enter into community. McIntyre pushes very hard against that conception of the human being, but he recognizes its dominance in the way that, particularly in first world countries, we think about ourselves. We're individuals. We delight in our individuality, right? And what are the conceptions of the goods that we ought to seek, which dominate our lives? Well, for many contemporary individuals, what one ought to seek is what one prefers. In fact, the view of a successful human life is wrapped up in a kind of perverted quest for more and more and more preference maximization, right? There's really no end to that which you prefer, right? And there's no necessary order to what you prefer. But your life is dedicated to achieving those things that you prefer. So this conception of what it is to be a human being is one that can't really make sense of Aristotle and Aquinas' conception of justice as a virtue. It just won't fit within this conception, in large part because the very essence of justice, as Aristotle describes it in Book 5 of the Nicomachean Ethics, is that which is always another's good. Right? It's that virtue that perfects us insofar as we strive to promote the good of some other. Right? So it's a virtue that perfects us insofar as we achieve and promote good for others. Right? If you are an individualistic preference maximizer, that doesn't make sense. Right? Now, somebody might have a preference to do good for others, but they could wake up the next day and have a different set of preferences, and that would be their prerogative to pursue. So you don't find within this particular conception of what it is to be a human being, then, room, as I said, for what justice is. So let me say a little bit more about this notion of the individualistic preference maximizer. So this is somebody who thinks he himself to be independent, and yet is, as Augustine would readily recognize, right, tied to his passions in some significant way. There's not a horizon of pursuit that really extends beyond that which one desires and exercises a preference for. Right? So you should be asking yourself, and we can focus on this in the Q&A if you like, is it really the case that that's a dominant way of thinking about what it is to be a human being today? Right? Does it fit you? Does it fit those you know? And McIntyre is not arguing so carelessly in this text to suggest that we're all perfectly fitted into this conception of what it is to be a human being. Rather, each of us is a denizen of different conceptions of what it is to be a human being. But as more and more of the older community-grounded ways of living have fallen away, this has been the dominant alternative, right? So you might think of the way you operate on the internet, where you click on those things that are your preferences. Right, and I would submit that the internet and social media in general is changing in fundamental ways the way we think about our humanity. Right, so you navigate the World Wide Web by clicking on your preferences, making your way through. You start navigating your actual life in a very similar manner, or maybe the latter actually preceded the former and is part of the success of the internet. I don't know. But you know, is this really the case? Is this the way that most people are living, a life in which they can't recognize certain fundamental goods. So part and parcel to this conception of the individualistic preference maximizer is the notion that there are no obligations that you bear simply because of your humanity, right? Those obligations, those responsibilities that you come to bear are directly the result of your choices, right? So you choose to enter into a relationship, then you are obligated to care for your spouse or your children. You choose in some way to live out the obligation to care for your parents, you might say, right? This starts to break down when you think about your parents or when you think about your siblings or you think about those who offered you your education in some fundamental way, those people who set you on your path, right? But if you're an individualistic preference maximizer, you find yourself not recognizing that there's a fundamental indebtedness that you have to those who provided care to you that orients your obligations, but this is rather a choice, right? People say that sometimes. They say, well, that's fine for her so long as it's her choice, right, or him, just so long as that's what he chose, right, then it's okay. Right? And choice, in that sense, is, I think, fitting this notion of a preference maximizer. Okay, so contrasted with this conception of the human being as a preference maximizer is that, and I'll draw just one more time from McIntyre here, that of a dependent rational animal, right? You've probably heard of the definition of the human being as the rational animal. That's a quite old one. And what one means by it, you can look in the politics and see the argument for yourself, is that one is rational insofar as one engages in speech. And in speech, one reflects upon the good and the bad, the just and the unjust, the expedient and the inexpedient. I'm just pulling from book one of Aristotle's Politics here. Okay? So that's what it is to be rational. Aristotle also says in several places in his Ethics that the human being, anthropos, man, is an arche of practicon. Right? He's a source of action, a starting point, fundamental starting point of action. And that, too, in Aristotle's reflections, is caught up in what it means to be a rational animal. Okay? What McIntyre supplies in his book by that title, Dependent Rational Animals, Why Human Beings Need the Virtues, is a set of arguments that suggests that we've overlooked, we being mainly philosophers, because most human beings seem to have gotten this right, but we overlook our dependency upon others. And in doing so, we've overlooked something fundamental to what it is to be a fully rational, in the sense of prudent, wise human being. And it's a remarkable thing that we've overlooked this, given the fact that we all have come from mothers. We've all had people care for us for very long periods of time. And I was a parent of more than one child, that time can feel very, very long indeed. And you think, when's this kid going to stop using diapers? This is disgusting. Somebody feeds us for years and changes our diapers. And we're dependent upon those people, whether or not they were your parents. Somebody cared for you and brought you to adulthood. And if you're really fortunate, you'll end your long years of life with somebody feeding you and changing your diaper and moving you so that you don't get bed sores, right? So our lives are encompassed on the two ends of it with profound care provided us by others. And in between, we often feel as though we're fully independent, particularly when you're a freshman or like a sophomore in college, right? That's where this sophomoric term comes from, right? A wise fool. You think you know it all. You're fully your own woman, fully your own man. You don't need anyone else, right? So I have a son who's 18 right now, and he's intelligent and hardworking, but really stupid in some ways, right? Because I can see that he just thinks he is on top of everything, and he's not rebellious, but he's feeling his energy, his independence, forgetting the fact that we're providing him with a bed and food and an education, and even, you know, he's working, and that's part of why he working part time. Part of why he feels such independence, right? And I'm sure you've had those feelings too, and they can be magnified. In fact, we can think that that's what life is all about, that kind of independence. But even in our most radical moments of independence, not only do we remain dependent upon others, if you reflect upon it at some length, but we also are somehow less than fully alive as human beings if we don't acknowledge the radical dependency that was at our origin and see that as an essential feature of what it is to be a human being now, right? Because it's only by doing that that we can live out the kind of life that really is consonant with our flourishing as human beings. Okay, so think about that. Here's an Aristotelian principle for you. One can only flourish as the sort of being one is. Right? You can only flourish as the sort of being you are. If you are an individual who's goals in life are to maximize your preferences, you will think of what it is to flourish in a fundamentally different way than if you are a dependent, rational animal, one who acknowledges your dependency upon others and recognizes it as part of your full humanity to exercise care and concern for others who come into your path. Many of whom, whether or not you chose to care for them or enter into a relationship with them, right? So you will have a very different conception of human flourishing if that is your view of what it is to be a human being. And I would submit that human beings are the latter, and it should be obvious to us as 21st century Americans, or those living in America. I don't want to presume you're all Americans. My apologies for any non-Americans here. But 21st century people spending a lot of time on college campuses should know better. And yet we delude ourselves quite a bit. And we fancy ourselves to be able to flourish as individuals who don't really need to exercise serious care for others to flourish, right? So exercising serious care for others in a kind of generous way is an important part of what justice is. I mean, a generous way, sometimes we can think of justice as a kind of unwilling yielding to another, right? Their due. Yeah, I've got to be just. But doing so generous spirit, a cheerful spirit, exercising justice for others, that can be seen as a perfection of a human being only if you acknowledge your dependency upon others, that you are a dependent, rational animal. So getting one's anthropology right makes all the difference in the world. And this is much of the work that goes on in philosophy classrooms. I know here there are several people who work extensively on the question of, you know, what is life, what is human nature, what is it to flourish as a human being, what are the fundamental goods of a human being. And there are competing answers to those questions, and it matters tremendously how you answer them, right? It matters tremendously in this sense. It will determine how you live your life, right? Because you can't but want to flourish. Okay, so I've talked a bit about what justice isn't and anthropology. I want to say a few things about what justice is. And I'm just going to crib from Aquinas here and define justice as a habitual perfection of the will by means of which we perpetually seek to render to each his good. Okay, so maybe I'll write that on the board.
With this really great lighting utensil.
Okay, so justice is a habit or habitus. I'm going to say that means a perfective habit of the will. Thank you. You came well armed. I've been graced with a writing utensil. So, sorry, that's a dad joke. You have to appreciate puns if you are around me very often. Okay, so justice is a perfective habit of the will by which we render to each his due. So, Aquinas argues that each of the virtues each virtue needs, so to speak, a home within the human person, right? So the virtue of courage is a perfection, a habitus of the irascible appetite, that appetite by means of which we rise up in defense of what we love. And the virtue of temperance is a perfection, a habitus of your concupiscible appetite, which is your appetite for things that are good and attractive and satisfying, completive of you. I could go through a number of other virtues here, but what's fascinating about his account of the virtues is the care he takes to trace each of the virtues to particular powers of the human being. And justice is traced to the will as its housing power, if you like. So justice principally is a perfection of our will. Our will, of course, is involved in every deliberative act, every act of a human being. Justice is then potentially part of every action. I say potentially because, of course, we don't have to have this virtue. Also, notice the stress on the habit here. Okay, so we sometimes fall into thinking of virtues in terms of their acts, right? Courage is not an action. Courage is a habit. Right? Justice is not an action. And you can have a just act. That would be an act minimally that is the sort of act that a just person would perform. But it's possible for someone to perform a just action without, in fact, being in possession of the virtue of justice. In fact, that happens all the time. If your reason for doing just actions are to avoid the penalty of the law, right? As your principal motivation, okay? So to have a virtue is to have a virtue. And the goal, obviously, is not simply to be or to have the virtues, but to act virtuously. What we want to act, we want to perform virtuous acts virtuously. And I'm not trying to speak in riddles here. But the goal, one way of thinking about the goal of the moral life is to exercise the virtues, so to do those things that are in accord with the virtues from a virtuous character, right? We'll take people acting virtuously even if their character is not virtuous. That's a big improvement over the vicious. But our goal is to be both perfect. Remember, virtues perfect a human being and enable their work to be done well. Okay, so there are in Aquinas' account and Aristotle's account, I'll draw mainly from Aristotle's language in Book 5 of the Nicomachean Ethics here. There's justice in the general sense. Okay, so this is that virtue that enables one to always render to each his due. This is the virtue which is, in a certain sense, it requires the perfection of all the other virtues. Okay, so it's the crown of the virtues, Aristotle says, because if one has justice, then one also exercises temperance and courage and the other virtues that we sometimes think of as personal virtues. Although courage is both personal and political. Okay, so it implies all the virtues. And this is distinct from two particular types of justice. Corrective justice, like writing is not very neat, it needs correction. And distributive justice. Okay? So justice that's exercised in order to repair wrongs done, that's corrective justice. And justice, insofar as it's exercised, the virtue of justice, insofar as it's exercised to distribute goods properly. And Aristotle's thinking principally of honors within a city, right? Having a street named after you, having the Darla Moore Business School, right? That's that will only cost you $70 million. And some other honorable actions. I learned at dinner, so I'd never heard of Darla Moore before. But that's an honor bestowed upon someone for their great work and to act with magnificent generosity is a great work. So I think it's easier to think of justice in these particular senses in the context of the family, right? So a mother or a father will correct a wrong. And I remember I was reading some philosophical text. I don't remember the text. I was in graduate school at the time, and we had our two oldest kids in the bathtub. And I was supposed to be watching them. That's what my wife had assigned as my task. And I was glancing at them on occasion and reading this book. And I happened to glance at them at this moment, probably because there was a stirring in the water. But the three-year-old had just stolen some toy that the one-and-a-half-year-old was playing with. And the one-and-a-half-year-old stood up and bopped his brother on the head. And then sat back down, grabbed the toy, and his older brother was a little stunned. But I saw what looked to me like recognition of the appropriateness of his younger brother's action. Right? There was a correction that was made. He had stolen a toy. Justice was rendered. Parents dole out punishments of all different sorts. Right? And my wife and I like to get creative with our punishments sometimes. For instance, when when siblings bicker, I tried this first about 12 years ago, and it's been very effective. If there's persistent bickering and negative humor between a couple of siblings, then I have them compose poems that praise the talents
and virtues of the sibling that they've been riding for a while. And that's onerous and painful, and somehow seems to fit the offense. Right? So I'm sure your parents had similarly whimsical punishments sometimes, or just painful punishments, but this is all a matter of exercising justice within the home. And then the distribution of goods, of course, there are the physical goods, food and shelter and so forth, but giving praise where it's deserved, and giving blame where it's deserved. Praise and blame are principal tools in the toolbox of parents, and exercising praise and blame well is a matter of acting upon justice as a virtue. Okay, so, like I said, this is a crash course on justice, and I'm happy to try to take on some other elements of it if it comes out in the Q&A. But now I want to talk about why one ought to strive to be just in the sense of justice as a virtue. And to do that, I want to talk about beauty for a little bit. So I started thinking about this argument. I just finished a paper not so long ago because of I had a friend who was trying to put together a group of scholars to think about beauty in the tradition. And I have been working on the virtues for some years and had already written a few things on Aristotle's account of beauty. He says that every virtue is takhalon, it's beautiful, fine, noble, and done for the sake of takhalon. So every virtue is beautiful and done for the sake of beauty. And that's certainly a notion that sounds very unfamiliar to our ears. What on earth could he mean by that? And this is an idea that I think has some resonance also in Aquinas' reflections on the virtues. It comes out especially in his treatment of bonum honestum, the honest good. And he reflects upon the connection between the virtues and beauty. But I was thinking about this, but also thinking about beauty in some other senses as well, as a way in part to chase out what we mean. If you've read Aristotle at all, and he talks about doing something for its own sake, okay, I think that that's connected to this notion of beauty. Beauty has a kind of motivating power on its own. And why is that? So I've been thinking about that for a while. I don't know if my answers are good answers yet. You can tell me. But the paper's done and accepted, so it might need to be revised. So Aquinas, if we just think of his three principles of beauty, he says that beauty is that which is perfective or complete. It has a kind of right proportion. And a certain clarity or splendor to it. Okay, so that which is beautiful has these three features. It's perfective, or it's got a certain perfection to it, and it's got a right proportion of parts to whole, and it's got this clarity or splendor. So by perfection, what he means is that the beautiful thing is, as it were, fully itself, okay, or nearly fully itself. So think of a beautiful animal, maybe a horse. Right? Or think of a portrait. Right? That might be more helpful. So a beautiful portrait. There's something complete, right? What's the purpose of a portrait? Well, it's not merely to do what a photograph does, right? A portrait is supposed to reveal the character of the person in the portrait. Right? So there's a certain perfection that's achieved in a and a beautiful portrait. The parts are proportionate to each other, so it conveys the person who's been painted in some proper way.
If you've read The Republic, you know, there's this discussion of beauty at a distance as opposed to close up. And
what is that in? Book? Is that beginning of book four, where Aristotle talks about the statue as being beautiful, but if you get too close, then it looks grotesque in some way, or Socrates describes that. So anyways, beauty in that description, beauty in our portrait, it's a matter of the proportion of the parts to each other. And then there's a certain clarity or splendor, right? The portrait communicates something about it. And I want to argue that part of what a beautiful thing communicates is a kind of motivation to imitate. Okay, here's another Platonic reference. In the Symposium, the priestess Diotima, who provides the account that becomes really the core of Socrates' account of beauty and love, argues that that which is beautiful is reproductive. Okay. So this certainly is the way beauty functions in the case of animal attraction, right? Human attraction, principally, if you think of romantic attraction, right? Beauty wants to reproduce in the sense of children, but beauty strives for a kind of reproduction too, in terms of conversations that you've had. You know, you're getting to know a beloved, and you had a wonderful conversation. You want more. You want more of that sort of thing. Right? Beauty has this kind of imitative, reproductive power. And justice, and each of the other virtues, I think, can be seen to fit this mystic account of the three elements of beauty, insofar as justice is a perfection of a human being and puts him or her in right relation to others. And there's something that is inspiring about the just person, so that we are motivated to similarly be just. Okay? So beauty has a kind of motivation in and of itself that is, I would suggest, infectious, if that's the right word. And this is the case with each of the virtues. It's the case even with each virtuous action. We glimpse something that is worthy of reproduction in a generous action, a really honest action, particularly one that was difficult for the person to do. I mean, think of the characters that you admire in novels you read or shows that you've watched, right? And you are inspired to go and do likewise. You want to be like those people. Right? So that's the power of beauty. And we tend to think of beauty in ways that isolate it to museums or to just romantic love, but I think it's far more pervasive than that. In fact, it's property of every being insofar as it's a being. Everything is beautiful, and this goes especially for the virtues. So, justice. We ought to strive to be just because it's beautiful, which is to say it's worthy of acquisition and action in and of itself. Okay? Second reason why we ought to strive to be just is that it promotes the common good. And we take
responsibility for ourselves and others by means of justice. That's to connect to the last two reasons why we ought to be just, right? The first of those last two being that we ought to be just because it's God-like. And the second of those last, or the third and the fourth, is that we ought to be just because it makes you happy. Right? You're happy right now, listening to this talk, I'm sure. And you're happier still when you act justly. So how is wanting to be godlike wrapped up with the virtue of justice, and how can we argue that we ought to want to be godlike? And there's a lot that could be said on that, and I won't try to say much of it at all. But one doesn't have to be a Christian or a Catholic to recognize the goal of wanting to be godlike. Right? Most religions recognize this as a goal. That is, one ought to strive to imitate God in some fashion. Even an old pagan like Aristotle built his ethics around one's efforts to strive to be godlike. Now, he's an interesting case insofar as his God is not just. Aristotle's God is not just. And he doesn't love you. You love him, and everything loves him, but he's a special case. At least Aristotle's God, as we meet him in the Nicomachean Ethics. There is a passage in Book 7, Chapter 15 of the Eudemian Ethics in which Aristotle talks about God in terms of the measure of all of our moral actions. But I don't have to argue that one recognizes that God is just in order to argue that one ought to strive to be as godlike as possible. And if you have a conception of God that also recognizes God to be one who exercises justice, then you ought to strive to be just like God. Right. So that's a very quick argument. And then the last reason, right, this is the reason that I really started with, right? You ought to strive to be just because your happiness and the sense of human flourishing is dependent upon it. You ought to strive to be just like your life depends upon it, because it does. At least, it depends upon being just in the sense of justice as a virtue. So I will stop there, and I'm happy to take questions.
I really like your analogy of beauty and justice being similar or identical. But I guess I have two questions. The first is, do you see beauty as objective? As in, there exists some objective beauty either in like some Platonic sense or in some other definable sense. Mm-hmm. And if not, does that mean if virtue and beauty are intrinsically tied, that beauty is, and if virtue is itself subjective?
Okay, so by objective, you mean, are some things in fact beautiful?
More or less.
And yes, I do think some things are in fact beautiful, whether or not they're noticed to be such.
Right.
And yet I don't want to suggest that there is not what I think you mean by a subjective dimension to this. Mm-hmm. Right? So you have to be able to recognize the beauty of justice if you're to be motivated by it, which most of the time means you have to have been given the right kinds of seeds in your education to flower into a kind of likeness for things that fit the way you've been raised. Mm-hmm. And even in the case of those who've suffered really horrible upbringing, I think there still remains within their nature an ability to recognize justice as beautiful. That's an expression of what one
usually means by the natural law, right, insofar as one's natural habit. Aquinas doesn't hesitate to use this expression that we have by nature a certain habit of holding on to first moral principles. And that's what, even for those who've really lived vicious lives or who have suffered oppressive childhoods are still not without hope because they hold on to this orientation towards those things that are fundamentally good for us, and justice is certainly one of those. So I'm not sure if you want to ask whether there might be people who aren't motivated by justice or...
No, by answering that beauty is, in your view, subjective, that I guess that's more asking if you believe that, and if you don't, then there might be a problem with your definition, but since you believe beauty's...
It doesn't mean that that there aren't things to argue about.
Yeah, of course.
When it comes to particular beautiful things. Mm-hmm. So my wife thinks certain colors and certain rooms are really beautiful, and I practice indifference to that. Even if I thought, well, these aren't particularly beautiful, but I would argue as a matter of principle, actually, that every thing, insofar as it is beautiful. And we may not always be able to appreciate its beauty, though. At least not in its outward appearance, and beauty really does stress outward appearance, and that's a large part of what's going on with this notion of clarity or splendor. But there's a beauty to being itself. Yes, Grace.
So you mentioned that we strive to be like characters in movies or literature that are that we admire, right? So what's like a character? Who's been like a character in literature or a movie that you think exemplifies justice really well?
Oh, let's see. How about Aragorn from The Lord of the Rings? Okay. The novel, not the movie.
there are a number of characters. There's some of the characters that we admire in, say, the more recent explosions of the Marvel universe seem to miss some features of justice insofar as they're usually acting outside the law. But the law is corrupt in some way, and so there's some ambiguity there. But in terms of universal admiration, Aragorn. Yes?
Two-part question. The first part is serious, and the second part, almost serious.
Mm-hmm.
It's about the third motivation for being just, which is that it's godly.
Yeah.
Especially this week, seems appropriate to note that the narrative of the history of God depicted in the Old and New Testaments is actually of a God that in every striking respect is not just, but merciful, always going to be justice. So I wonder, the first question is justice really, is being God-like really an appropriate motive for being just? Is just really the virtue that you should strive for if you want to be God-like?
Mm-hmm.
And then the second part, less serious, but just sort of provoked by the first part, is if to the extent that you move more towards the idea of mercy as the godlike virtue, is there perhaps something edifying about the move away from justice as a virtue in contemporary discourse that can serve as a kind of reminder that this is not, in fact, the social virtue for Christians?
I would not divorce mercy and justice in the way it sounds like you are, or oppose them, let's say, right? So mercy presupposes justice, and I don't think it suspends
justice as a virtue, right? You couldn't appreciate God's mercy if you did not recognize your unworthiness to receive it. And so our appreciation for our sinfulness, our appreciation for the remarkable distance there is between God and man, and the profound condescension that God engaged in order to assume human flesh, all is rooted in an appreciation for God's justice. And the mercy then is born, I would argue, from his justice and supersedes it in the sense of suspending the execution of that which is owed and offering instead grace and mercy. But we're talking about acts there, as opposed to, or actions, as opposed to the being of God, right? So if God was not fundamentally just, his mercy wouldn't make sense. If we didn't recognize God's justice, then we wouldn't be able to appreciate his mercy as mercy. We would just be like, yeah, come on. This is what I deserve. Mercy. You're the God who takes care of my needs and extends heaven to me. Like it's no big deal, right? So part of what I think we have to remember as Christians is just on the one hand how what a remarkable gift it is that this occurs. That God extends this profound mercy to us and not take it for granted, which I think in large part does rest in a recognition of justice. So similarly, to go to the second part of your question, I don't think of justice as the supreme social virtue, and I see it as being taken up into charity, and charity as Aquinas defines it in Secunda Secundae, question 23, as the God's befriending of the human being, right? So that friendship that's been extended to us through God's mercy elevates us into his life, and that's a kind of perfection of justice. I love my wife, I hope, with Christian charity as well as in other ways, but and it certainly would be inadequate if I say, well, I'm going to pull my fair share, and this is a partnership, and we're going to work together. I'm going to do my part. I mean, that would somehow be really inadequate as a husband for me to express our relationship in those terms, which are grounded in the language of justice. Right? But that doesn't mean that justice has been obliterated, and I'd rather like to think of it as being taken up to and perfected in friendship. Not unlike the way in which Aristotle makes that move to think about friendship as a further perfection of justice in his book 8, right? He wonders, is it a virtue or a part of virtue? So it's not supreme, but it is. It is a, a virtue of human individuals that require us to be focused on the common good. And a further perfection of that focus on the common good is charity. And yet, charity does not destroy every virtue, but in fact,
elevates it. Is that okay?
Can I push back just a tiny little bit? I mean, just for the sake of, I mean, getting you to say a little bit more. And you have the definition of justice up there that involves giving one's due. So I don't think mercy obliterates justice. And I think there has to be something about it in some way perfecting justice. I think there's a puzzle there. Right? How does it perfect justice when justice is giving something its due?
Right.
And the mercy of God is clearly not doing that. And all through the description that you've just given, right? I mean, the gift stuff is not any, you know, it's not our due.
Right.
The atonement is not, it's not due to us.
But the due is paid, just not by us.
What's that?
The due is paid, just not by us. Pretty standard stuff.
Yeah, I had some problems with the standard stuff, actually.
Exactly. Yeah, no, but that's an excellent point. So, I mean, the due is paid, but again, I want to go back to you know, God wills justice. God also wills mercy, and the mercy being mercy requires a recognition of justice, right? And so, you know, a perfection of the will by which we render to each his due doesn't have to be accomplished in action in each particular instance for the virtue still to remain. But I can't make sense of mercy without making sense of justice. And would agree, I would argue that, yeah, the debt has been paid as well. Other questions? Yeah, please.
You seem to offer pretty early on a critique of, like, the liberal conception of the self as something that's impoverished, right? And then you asked us the question, you know, does this really map on to our conception of what the human condition is or something like that? But it seems to me that what liberal theories of justice are doing, you can take a look at Rawls or Kant in specific, they're not making an ontological claim about the human condition, but instead a normative claim that principles of justice should be procured from a position where we abstract from what people's ends are to their rational agency. Right, and so it seems somewhat, or at least like prima facie, irrelevant as an objection to say, like we can say in economics, when we're trying to make a predictive model, that if this doesn't track our everyday conception of the self, then we're missing out on some predictive power in our model if we make a rational expectations assumption. Mm-hmm. But in a normative theory, it doesn't seem to be subject to that same objection. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that point. But I don't think you've gotten away from the anthropological concern. So Rawls is very helpful if you imagine yourself as you might find yourself, or I often in my work as a university administrator, I have to develop policies, and I sit around a table, not unlike the way that Rawls imagines the original conversation. We don't quite have the veil of ignorance fully employed there, but we do ask questions like, "Well, you know, will this policy benefit those who are in the most disadvantageous position at the university?" So, like health insurance policies and investment policies and policies of an academic sort, policies about students living on campus. And we have stricter rules about that than you would at South Carolina. Rawls is really, really effective there. And you do see the normative work going on with people who have never read Rawls and never will read Rawls, right? But they're doing the sort of thing that he describes. And yet, that can't be an account of the whole of one's life, it seems, right? So it's got a particular part to play. Rawls doesn't make room for the rest, so to speak. If you think of the end of A Theory of Justice or political liberalism, there is a conception about how to live one's life that seems to be tied to this important set of practices that do not encompass the whole of what we mean by pursuing goods proper to our nature. So, how exactly he moves from a more limited reflection upon deliberative practices to a set of claims about the whole of one's life is a messy story, but it's sort of there at the beginning of A Theory of Justice, I would argue. And part of what is motivating about it, right? So there's a Rousseauian stream that runs into Rawls. We don't just have to look to Rawls either for this conception. But I think you're right to think about deliberative practices and certain kinds of normative theories as being effective and useful and really significant to the kind of practices that institutions are engaged in. And I want to give them their due. But it seems to me to have stretched by design well beyond that, at least in modern thinkers, Hobbes, Locke, Rousseau, in the view of the human being in the state of nature.
So you're fine with abstracting from those ends insofar as we're procuring principles of justice for institutions, right?
In certain contexts, right? Okay. But those institutions, in the example I gave, are already dedicated to certain goods, right? So the first good of a university, the primary good of a university, is the truth. Right? And one thinks about how to design an education in pursuit of the truth and what that means. Okay, so that's a given. And I don't think it belongs to these kinds of deliberative practices to consider up for grabs whether or not an education is dedicated to the truth. That's presupposed. Does that help?
I think so. And principles of justice are applicable to kinds of institutions like universities, you'd say.
Principles of justice?
Yeah.
Yeah. Which principles of justice?
Any principles that we would come to that are on the basis of, or so, in the concept of at least social contract, right, the principles of justice are based on like the idea of universal justifiability or something like that, right? I mean, it doesn't seem like these are the same kind of principles that we deal with when we're an organization that is directed to particular goods, right? The government or something like that, and by virtue of the social contract, we're looking at putting constraints on people's actions such that their pursuits don't conflict, rather than aiming towards a conception of the good that we're trying to realize.
That is part of what happens within government. Okay, and universities are different. I'm not sure if governments should be so different, within social contract theory, yes. Now you said universal justifiability. If I'm going to strip it down, I would say it's fear that is the motivator for the social contract.
I don't think that this is the liberal claim, at least for Kantians and Rawlsians. The idea is that we have to be able to, the test of legitimacy, or at least the constitutive principle of legitimacy, is something about
that the body acts according to principles that can be justifiable to each individual to attach themselves to the general will.
If you want to pull Kant into your liberalism,
sure.
Yeah. Then.
And I mean that was.
Then you know the categorical imperative meets Rousseau and Hobbes, and that's maybe a way to think about Rawls.
Mm.
But I would argue that the purposes of government ought not be merely to prevent us from harming each other. It ought to be the promotion of a life of virtue. And there are some connections between the government and universities like this one, right? And you receive public funding to do not very much.
Quite good.
All right. More than I receive at the University of Dallas, which is not a public institution. Education is seen as a good that ought to be promoted, right? And because of the virtues that are entailed by it. Yes, sir.
Do you see justice mostly as a civic virtue, similar to honesty, modesty, or frugality? Is it more of like caring for others?
I think it does. Yeah. So I think justice entails those virtues and more. Right. So I agree with Aristotle, who argues that justice is complete both in the sense that it's always another's good and that it implies the other virtues, at least those other virtues that are lower than justice, to go back to the conversation I had with Chris Paulson. In a certain sense, I would argue one can be just without exercising charity in the Christian sense, right? So, but one can't be just in the sense in possession of the virtue of justice and able to perform just actions because you are just, if you lack honesty and temperance and other virtues, right? Those are entailed by justice. Because dishonesty is to take from someone what they deserve, the truth. Yes.
So I'm kind of curious, as far as concerning unjustness or the opposite of justice, are people that behave justly always at a disadvantage to people that behave unjustly? Do you have to kind of understand that and live with that in order to live a just life?
That is a great question, Glaucon. And I don't know if you've ever read the Republic.
I don't know.
Okay, so. In the second book of the Republic, Plato's Republic, there are two brothers, they're actually the brothers of Plato, Glaucon and Mantis, and they're taking up elements of this question that you asked, and that's echoing things that a sophist, Thrasymachus, says in the first book, and it is the common conception that the just man is he who suffers. I can't remember the psalm. I was praying morning prayer this morning, and the psalm was encouraging us. The psalmist was encouraging us to not worry ourselves with the unjust, who seem indeed to be, gaining every advantage to our detriment. Right. So, are we always at a disadvantage? No. If you're aspiring for those goods that are proper to a human being, right? To paraphrase Socrates in the Apology, he argues that he is convinced that one could never be harmed, a just man could never be harmed by an unjust man. Now, that doesn't mean that his goods couldn't be stolen and other what we think of as harms done to him, but his goods as a human being in the sense of his possession of the conviction that one ought always to be just, right? That can't be harmed. His soul can't be harmed, right? Now, that's a pretty extreme view. And I would argue also that there are all kinds of provisions that one can turn to within justice. I mean, I don't think our law courts are so corrupt that one can't seek correction for harms done. And I know that there are plenty of problems in 21st century America, but still we have many sound principles animating our government and our law courts and the justice system. So there is redress. Ultimately, the unjust person, you could say, is harming himself more than anyone else by escaping taxes and other penalties through deception or other kinds of misdeeds. Right? There's a harm to his own soul, I would argue, with Plato and Aristotle a little bit less robustly behind you. Okay. But it seems that way, which is why the psalmist calls us to our attention in many places. It seems that way. Yeah. Quite a bit. Well, you've been very kind. It's been great to spend some time with you. And thanks for putting up with my stupid jokes and my boring lecture and ask great questions. So have a blessed morning. Thank you.